It was cold up there at 10,000 feet or more, and Oberhauser had got into the hut and was busy preparing a fire. Major Smythe controlled his horror at the sight. "Oberhauser," he said cheerfully, "come out and show me some of the sights. Wonderful view up here."
"Certainly, Major."
Oberhauser followed Major Smythe out of the hut. Outside, he fished in his hip pocket and produced something wrapped in paper. He undid the paper to reveal a hard, wrinkled sausage. He offered it to the Major.
"It is only what we call a solda," he said shyly. "Smoked meat. Very tough, but good,"
he smiled.
"It is like what they eat in Wild West films. What is the name?"
"Biltong," said the Major. Then, and later this had slightly disgusted him, he said, "Leave it in the hut. We will share it later.
Come over here. Can we see Innsbruck? Show me the view on this side."
Oberhauser bobbed into the hut and out again. The Major fell in just behind him as he talked, pointing out this or that distant church spire or mountain peak. They came to the point above the glacier. Major Smythe drew his revolver, and at a range of 2 feet, fired 2 bullets into the base of Hannes Oberhauser's skull. No muffing. Dead on. The impact of the bullets knocked the guide clean off his feet and over the edge. Major Smythe craned over. The body hit twice only, and then crashed onto the glacier. But not onto its fissured origin. Halfway down, and on a patch of old snow. "Hell!" said Major Smythe. The deep boom of the 2 shots that had been batting to and fro among the mountains died away. Major Smythe took 1 last look at the black splash on the white snow and hurried off along the shoulder.
"First things first."
He started on the top of the cairn, working as if the devil was after him, throwing the rough, heavy stones indiscriminately down the mountain to right or left. His hands began to bleed, but he hardly noticed. Now there were only 2 feet or so left,
and nothing, bloody nothing.
He bent to the last pile, scrabbling feverishly.
And then, yes, the edge of a metal box. A few more rocks away, and there was the whole of it. A good old grey Wehrmacht ammunition box with the trace of some lettering still on it.
Major Smythe gave a groan of joy. He sat down on a hard piece of rock, and his mind went orbiting through Bentleys, Monte Carlo, penthouse, flats, Cartiers, champagne, caviar, and incongruously, but because he loved golf, a new set of Henry Cotton irons. Drunk with his dreams, Major Smythe sat there looking at the grey box for a full quarter of an hour. Then he glanced at his watch and got briskly to his feet. Time to get rid of the evidence. The box had a handle at each end. Major Smythe had expected it to be heavy. He had mentally compared its probable weight with the heaviest thing he had ever carried, a 40-pound salmon he'd caught in Scotland just before the war. But the box was more than double that weight, and he was only just able to heave it out of its last bed of rocks onto the thin alpine grass. He slung his handkerchief through one of the handles and dragged it clumsily along the shoulder to the hut. Then he sat down on the stone doorstep, and his eyes, never leaving the box, tore at Oberhauser's smoked sausage with his strong teeth and thought about getting his £50,000, for that was the figure he put it at, down the mountain and into a new hiding place. Oberhauser's sausage was a real mountaineer's meal, tough, well-fatted and strongly garlicked. Bits of it stuck uncomfortably between Major Smythe's teeth. He dug them out with a sliver of matchstick and spat them on the ground. Then his intelligence-wise mind came into operation, and he meticulously searched among the stones and grass, picked up the scraps, and swallowed them. From now on, he was a criminal. As much a criminal as if he'd robbed a bank and shot the guard. He was a cop-turned-robber.
He must remember that. It would be death if he didn't. Death instead of Cartier's. All he had to do was to take infinite pains. He would take those pains, and by God, they would be infinite. Then, forever after, he would be rich and happy. After taking ridiculously minute trouble to eradicate any sign of entry into the hut, he dragged the ammunition box to the edge of the last rock face and, aiming it away from the glacier, tipped it, with a prayer, into space. The grey box, turning slowly in the air, hit the first steep slope below the rock face, bounded another 100 feet, and landed with an iron clang and some loose scree, and stopped. Major Smythe couldn't see if it had burst open. He didn't mind one way or the other. The mountain might as well do it for him. With a last look round, he went over the edge. He took great care at each piton, tested every handhold and foothold before he put weight on them. Coming down, he was a much more valuable life than he had been climbing up. He made for the glacier and trudged across the melting snow to the black patch on the ice field. There was nothing to be done about footprints. It would only take a few days for them to be melted down by the sun. He got to the body. He'd seen many corpses during the war, and the blood and broken limbs meant nothing to him. He dragged the remains of Oberhauser to the nearest deep crevasse and toppled it in. Then he went carefully round the lip of the crevasse and kicked the snow overhang down on top of the body. Satisfied with his work, he retraced his steps, placing his feet exactly in his old footprints, and made his way on down the slope to the ammunition box. Yes, the mountain had burst open the lid for him. Almost casually, he tore away the cartridge paper wrappings. The two great hunks of metal glittered up at him under the sun. There were the same markings on each. The swastika in a circle below an eagle, and the date, 1943. The mint marks over the Reichsbank. Major Smythe gave a nod of approval. He replaced the paper and hammered the crooked lid half shut with a rock. Then he tied the lanyard of his Webley round one of the handles and moved on down the mountain, dragging his clumsy burden behind him. It was now 1 o'clock, and the sun beat fiercely down on his naked chest, frying him in his own sweat. His reddened shoulders began to burn. So did his face. To hell with them! He stopped at the stream from the glacier, dipped his handkerchief in the water and tied it across his forehead. Then he drank deeply and went on, occasionally cursing the ammunition box as it caught up with him and banged at his heels. But these discomforts, the sunburn and the bruises, were nothing compared with what he would have to face when he got down to the valley and the going leveled out. For the time being, he had gravity on his side. There would come at least a mile when he would have to carry the blasted stuff. Major Smythe winced at the thought of the havoc it would wreak on his burned back. "Oh, well," he said to himself, almost lightheadedly. "Il faut souffrir pour être millionnaire." When he got to the bottom and the time had come, he sat and rested on a mossy bank under the firs. Then he spread out his bush shirt and heaved the 2 bars out of the box and onto its center, tying the tails of the shirt as firmly as he could to where the sleeves sprang from the shoulders. After digging a shallow hole in the bank and burying the empty box, he knotted the 2 cuffs of the sleeves firmly together, knelt down, and slipped his head through the rough sling. Got his hands on either side of the knot to protect his neck, and staggered to his feet, crouching far forward so as not to be pulled over on his back. Then, crushed under half his own weight, his back on fire under the contact with his burden, and his breath rasping through his constricted lungs, coolie-like, he shuffled slowly off down the little path through the trees. To this day, he didn't know how he had made it to the jeep. Again and again the knots gave under the strain, and the bars crashed down on the calves of his legs, and each time he had sat with his head in his hands, and then started all over again. But finally, by concentrating on counting his steps and stopping for a rest at every hundredth, he got to the blessed little car and collapsed beside it. And then there had been the business of burying his hoard in the wood, amongst a jumble of big rocks that he would be sure to find again, and of cleaning himself up as best he could, and getting back to his billet by a circuitous route that avoided the Oberhauser chalet. And then it was all done, and he had got drunk by himself on a bottle of cheap schnapps, eaten and gone to bed into a stupefied sleep. The next day, MOB A-Force had moved off up the Mittersill Valley on a fresh trail, and 6 months later, Major Smythe was back in London, and his war was over. But not his problems. Gold is difficult stuff to smuggle, certainly in the quantity available to Major Smythe, and it was now essential to get his two bars across the channel and into a new hiding place. So he put off his demobilization and clung to the privileges of his temporary rank, particularly to his military intelligence passes, and soon got himself sent back to Germany as a British representative at the Combined Interrogation Center in Munich. There he did a scratch job for 6 months, during which he collected his gold and stowed it away in a battered suitcase in his quarters. Then, on two weekend leaves, he flew to England, each time carrying one of the bars in a bulky briefcase. The walk across the tarmac at Munich and Northolt, and the handling of his case as if it contained only papers, required two benzedrine tablets and a will of iron. But at last he had his fortune, safe in the basement of an aunt's flat in Kensington, and could get on with the next phase of his plans at leisure. He resigned from the Royal Marines, got himself demobilized, and married one of the many girls he had slept with at MOB Force headquarters, a charming blonde wren called Mary Parnell, from a solid middle-class family. He got passages for them both in one of the early banana boats sailing from Avonmouth to Kingston, Jamaica, which they both agreed would be a paradise of sunshine, good food and cheap drink, and a glorious haven from the gloom, restrictions and Labour government of post-war England. Before they sailed, Major Smythe showed Mary the gold bars, from which he'd chiselled away the mint marks of the Reichsbank. "I've been clever, darling," he said. "I just don't trust the pound these days. So I've sold out all my securities and swapped the lot for gold. There'll be over £20,000 worth there if I play it right. That should give us a fair slice of the good life, just cutting off a chunk now and then and selling it." Mary Parnell was not familiar with the ramifications of the currency laws. She knelt down and ran her hands lovingly over the gleaming bars. Then she got up and threw her arms round Major Smythe's neck and kissed him. "You're a wonderful, wonderful man," she said, almost in tears. "Frightfully clever and handsome and brave, and now you're rich as well. I'm the luckiest girl in the world." "Well, anyway, we're rich," said Major Smythe. "But promise me you won't breathe a word, or we'll have all the burglars in Jamaica around our ears. Promise." "Cross my heart." Prince's Club, in the foothills above Kingston, was indeed a paradise. Pleasant enough members, wonderful servants, unlimited food and cheap drink, and all in the wonderful setting of the tropics that neither of them had known before. They were a popular couple, and Major Smythe's war record earned them the entree to Government House society, after which their life was one endless round of parties, with tennis for Mary and golf, with the Henry Cotton Irons, for Major Smythe. In the evenings there was bridge for her and the high poker game for him. Yes, it was paradise, all right. while in their homeland, people munched their spam, fiddled in the black market, cursed the government, and suffered the worst winter weather for 30 years. The Smythes met all their initial expenditure from their combined cash reserves, swollen by wartime gratuities, and it took Major Smythe a full year of careful sniffing around before he decided to do business with the Messrs. Fu, import and export merchants. The brothers Fu, highly respected and very rich, were the acknowledged governing junta of the flourishing Chinese community in Jamaica. Some of their trading was suspected to be devious in the Chinese tradition, but all Major Smythe's casually meticulous inquiries confirmed that they were utterly trustworthy. The Bretton Woods Convention, fixing a controlled world price for gold, had been signed, and it had already become common knowledge that in Tangier and Macau, two free ports which for different reasons had escaped the Bretton Woods net, a price of at least $100 per ounce of gold, 99 fine, could be obtained, compared with the fixed world price of $35 per ounce. And conveniently, the Fus had just begun to trade again with a resurgent Hong Kong, already the entrepot for gold smuggling into the neighbouring Macau. The whole setup was, in Major Smythe's language, tickety-boo. He had a most pleasant meeting with the Fu brothers. No questions were asked until it came to examining the bars. At this point, the absence of mint marks resulted in a polite inquiry as to the original provenance of the gold. "You see, Major," said the older and blander of the brothers behind the big empty mahogany desk, "in the bullion market, the mint marks of all respectable national banks and responsible dealers are accepted without question. Such marks guarantee the fineness of the gold. But of course, there are other banks and dealers whose methods of refining," his benign smile widened a fraction, "are perhaps not quite, shall we say, so accurate."
"You mean the old gold brick swindle," said Major Smythe with a twinge of anxiety. "Hunk of lead covered with gold plating."
Both brothers tee-heed reassuringly.
"No, no, Major. That, of course, is out of the question. But,"
the smiles held constant,
"if you cannot recall the provenance of these fine bars, perhaps you would have no objection if we were to undertake an assay. There are methods of determining the exact fineness of such bars. My brother and I are competent in these methods. If you will care to leave these with us, and perhaps come back after lunch."
There had been no alternative. Major Smythe had to trust the Fus utterly now. They could cook up any figure and he would just have to accept it. He went over to the Myrtle Bank and had one or two stiff drinks and a sandwich that stuck in his throat. Then he went back to the cool office of the Fus. The setting was the same. The two smiling brothers, the two bars of gold, the briefcase. But now there was a piece of paper and a gold Parker pen in front of the elder brother.
"We have solved the problem of your fine bars, Major."
"Fine. Thank God," thought Major Smythe.
"And I am sure you will be interested to know their probable history."
"Yes, indeed," said Major Smythe with a brave show of enthusiasm.
"They are German bars, Major. Probably from the wartime Reichsbank. This we have deduced from the fact that they contain 10% of lead. Under the Hitler regime, it was the foolish habit of the Reichsbank to adulterate their gold in this manner. This fact became rapidly known to dealers, and the price of German bars in Switzerland, for instance, where many of them found their way, was adjusted downwards accordingly. So, the only result of the German foolishness was that the National Bank of Germany lost a reputation for honest dealing it had earned over the centuries.
The Chinaman's smile didn't vary.
Very bad business measure. Very stupid.
Major Smythe marveled at the omniscience of these two men, so far from the great commercial channels of the world, but he also cursed it. Now what? He said,
"That's very interesting, Mr. Fu, but it is not very good news for me. Are these bars not good delivery, or whatever you call it in the bullion world?"
The elder Fu made a slight throwaway gesture with his right hand.
"It is of no importance, Major. Or rather, it is of very small importance. We will sell your gold at its true mint value. Let us say, 89 fine. It may be refined by the ultimate purchaser, or it may not. That is not our business. We shall have sold a true bill of goods, but at a lower price. That is so, Major. But I think I have some good news for you. Have you any estimates as to the worth of these two bars?"
"I'd thought around £20,000.
The elder Fu gave a dry chuckle.
"I think if we sell wisely and slowly, you shall receive more than $100,000, Major. Subject, that is, to our commission, which will include shipping and incidental charges."
"How much would that be?"
"We were thinking about a figure of 10%, Major, if that is satisfactory to you."
Major Smythe had an idea that bullion brokers received a fraction of 1%. But what the hell? He had already as good as made £10,000 since lunch. He said, "Done," and got up and reached his hand across the desk. From then on, every quarter he would visit the office of the Foos, carrying an empty suitcase. There would be 500 new Jamaican pounds in neat bundles on the broad desk, and the two gold bars that diminished inch by inch, together with a typed slip showing the amount sold and the price obtained in Macau. It was all very simple and friendly and highly businesslike, and Major Smythe didn't think that he was being submitted to any form of squeeze other than the duly recorded 10%. In any case, he didn't particularly care. 2,000 net a year was good enough for him, and his only worry was that the income tax people would get after him and ask him what he was living on. He mentioned this possibility to the Foos, but they said he was not to worry. And for the next two quarters, there was only £400 instead of £500 on the table, and no comment was made by either side. Squeeze had been administered in the right quarter. And so the lazy, sunshiny days passed by and stretched out into years. The Smythes both put on weight, and Major Smythe had the first of his two coronaries and was told by his doctor to cut down on his alcohol and cigarettes and take life more easily. He was also to avoid fats and fried food. At first, Mary Smythe tried to be firm with him. Then, when he took to secret drinking and to a life of petty lies and evasions, she tried to backpedal on her attempts to control his self-indulgence. But she was too late. She had already become the symbol of the janitor to Major Smythe, and he took to avoiding her. She berated him with not loving her any more, and when the resultant bickering became too much for her simple nature, she became a sleeping pill addict. Then, after one flaming, drunken row, she took an overdose, just to show him. It was too much of an overdose, and it killed her. The suicide was hushed up, but the resultant cloud did Major Smythe no good socially, and he returned to the North Shore, which, although only some 3 miles across the island from the capital, is, even in the small society of Jamaica, a different world. And there he had settled in Wavelets, and after his second coronary was in the process of drinking himself to death, when this man called Bond arrived on the scene, with an alternative death warrant in his pocket. Major Smythe looked at his watch. It was a few minutes after 12 o'clock. He got up and poured himself another stiff brandy and ginger ale and went out onto the lawn. James Bond was sitting under the sea almonds, gazing out to sea. He didn't look up when Major Smythe pulled up another aluminium garden chair and put his drink on the grass beside him. When Major Smythe had finished telling his story, Bond said unemotionally, "Yes, that's more or less the way I figured it."
"Want me to write it all out and sign it?"
"You can if you like, but not for me. That'll be for the court-martial. Your old Cora will be handling that. I've got nothing to do with the legal aspects. I shall put in a report to my own service of what you've told me, and they'll pass it on to the Royal Marines. And I suppose it'll go to the public prosecutor via Scotland Yard."
"Could I ask a question?"
"Of course."
"How did they find out?"
"It was a small glacier. Oberhauser's body came out at the bottom of it earlier this year, when the spring snows melted. Some climbers found it. All his papers and everything were intact. The family identified him. Then it was just a question of working back. The bullets clinched it."
"But how did you get mixed up in the whole thing?"
"MOB Force was a responsibility of my, service. The papers found their way to us. I happened to see the file. I had some spare time on my hands. I asked to be given the job of chasing up the man who did it."
"Why?"
James Bond looked Major Smythe squarely in the eyes. "It just happened that Oberhauser was a friend of mine. He taught me to ski before the war, when I was in my teens. He was a wonderful man. He was something of a father to me, at a time when I happened to need one."
"Oh, I see."
Major Smythe looked away.
"I'm sorry."
James Bond got to his feet. "Well, I'll be getting back to Kingston." He held up a hand. "No, don't bother. I'll find my way to the car." He looked down at the older man. He said abruptly, almost harshly, perhaps Major Smythe thought to hide his embarrassment, "It'll be about a week before they send someone out to bring you home." Then he walked off across the lawn and through the house, and Major Smythe heard the iron whir of the self-starter and the clatter of the gravel on the unkempt drive. Major Smythe, questing for his prey along the reef, wondered what exactly those last words of the Bond man had meant. Inside the Pirelli, his lips drew mirthlessly back from the stained teeth. It was obvious, really. It was just a version of the corny old act of leaving the guilty officer alone with his revolver. If the Bond man had wanted to, he could have telephoned Government House and had an officer of the Jamaica Regiment sent over to take Major Smythe into custody. Decent of him in a way. Or was it? A suicide would be much tidier. Save a lot of paperwork and taxpayers' money. Should he oblige the Bond man and be tidy? Join Mary in whatever place suicides go to? Or go through with it? The indignity, the dreary formalities, the headlines, the boredom and drabness of a life sentence that would inevitably end with his third coronary. Or should he defend himself? Plead wartime? A struggle with Oberhauser on the Peak of Gold? Prisoner trying to escape? Oberhauser knowing of the gold cash?
the natural temptation of Smythe to make away with the bullion. He, a poor officer of the commandos, confronted with sudden wealth. Should he dramatically throw himself on the mercy of the court? Suddenly Major Smythe saw himself in the dock, a splendid upright figure, in the fine, bemedalled blue and scarlet of the ceremonial uniform, which was the traditional rig for courts martial.
Had the moths got into the japanned box in the spare room at Wavelets? Had the damp? Luna would have to look to it. A day in the sunshine if the weather held. Good brushing. With the help of his corset, he could surely still get his 40-inch waist into the 34-inch trousers Gives had built for him 30 years ago. And down on the floor of the court, at Chatham probably, the prisoner's friend, some staunch fellow, at least of colonel's rank in deference to his own seniority, would be pleading his cause. And there was always the possibility of appeal to a higher court. Why, the whole affair might become a cause célèbre. He would sell his story to the papers, write a book. Major Smythe felt the excitement mounting in him.
Careful, old boy, careful. Remember what the good old Snipcock had said.
He put his feet to the ground and had a rest, amidst the dancing waves of the nor'east trades that kept the North Shore so delightfully cool, until the torrid months, August, September, October, of the hurricane season. After his 2 pink gins, skimpy lunch, and happily sodden siesta, he would have to give all this more careful thought. And then there were cocktails with the Arundels, and dinner at the Shore Park Beach Club with the Marquesas. Then some high bridge and home to his seconal sleep. Cheered by the prospect of the familiar routine, the black shadow of Bond retreated into the background.
Now then, Scorp, where are you? Octopussy's waiting for her lunch.
Major Smythe put his head down, and his mind freshly focused and his eyes questing, continued his leisurely swim along the shallow valley between the coral clumps that led out towards the white-fringed reef. Almost at once, he saw the 2 spiny antennae of a lobster, or rather of its cousin, the West Indian longoust, weaving inquisitively towards him, towards the turbulence he was creating, from a deep fissure under a niggerhead. From the thickness of the antennae, it would be a big one, 3 or 4 pounds. Normally, Major Smythe would have put his feet down and delicately stirred up the sand in front of the lair to bring the lobster farther out, for they're an inquisitive family. Then he would have speared it through the head and taken it back for lunch. But today, there was only one prey in his mind, one shape to concentrate on, the shaggy, irregular silhouette of a scorpion fish. And 10 minutes later, he saw a clump of seaweedy rock on the white sand that just wasn't a clump of seaweedy rock. He put his feet softly down and watched the poison spines erect themselves along the back of the thing. It was a good-sized one, perhaps 3/4 of a pound. He got his 3-pronged spear ready and inched forward. Now the red, angry eyes of the fish were wide open and watching him. He would have to make a single quick lunge from as nearly the vertical as possible. Otherwise, he knew from experience, the barbed prongs, needle-sharp though they were, would almost certainly bounce off the horny head of the beast. He swung his feet up off the ground and paddled forward very slowly, using his free hand as a fin.
Now!
He lunged forwards and downwards, but the scorpion fish had felt the tiny approaching shockwave of the spear. There was a flurry of sand, and it had shot up in a vertical takeoff and whirred in almost bird-like flight under Major Smythe's belly. Major Smythe cursed and twisted round in the water.
Yes, it had done what they so often do, gone for refuge to the nearest algae-covered rock, and there, confident in its superb camouflage, gone to ground on the seaweed.
Major Smythe had only to swim a few feet, lunge down again, this time more accurately, and he had it, flapping and squirming on the end of his spear. The excitement and the small exertion had caused Major Smythe to pant, and he felt the old pain across his chest, lurking, ready to come at him. He put his feet down, and after driving his spear all the way through the fish, held it still flapping desperately out of the water. Then he slowly made his way back across the lagoon on foot and walked up the sand of his beach to the wooden bench under the sea grape. Then he dropped the spear with its jerking quarry on the sand beside him and sat down to rest. It was perhaps 5 minutes later that Major Smythe felt a curious numbness, more or less in the region of his solar plexus. He looked casually down and his whole body stiffened with horror and disbelief. A patch of his skin, about the size of a cricket ball, had turned white under his tan, and in the center of the patch there were three descending punctures topped by little beads of blood. Automatically, Major Smythe wiped away the blood. The holes were only the size of pinpricks, but Major Smythe remembered the rising flight of the scorpionfish, and he said aloud, with awe in his voice, but without animosity,
"You got me, you bastard. By God, you got me."
He sat very still, looking down at his body and remembering what it said about scorpion fish stings in the book he had borrowed from the Institute and had never returned. Dangerous Marine Animals, an American publication. He delicately touched and then prodded the white area around the punctures. Yes, the skin had gone totally numb, and now a pulse of pain began to throb beneath it. Very soon this would become a shooting pain. Then the pain would begin to lance all over his body and become so intense that he would throw himself on the sand, screaming and thrashing about to rid himself of it. He would vomit and foam at the mouth, and then delirium and convulsions would take over until he lost consciousness. Then, inevitably in his case, there would ensue cardiac failure and death. According to the book, the whole cycle would be complete in about a quarter of an hour. That was all he had left. 15 minutes of hideous agony. There were cures, of course. Procaine, antibiotics, and antihistamines, if his weak heart would stand them. But they had to be near at hand. And even if he could climb the steps up to the house, and supposing Jimmy Greaves had these modern drugs, the doctor couldn't possibly get to Wavelets in under an hour. The first jet of pain seared into Major Smythe's body and bent him over double. Then came another and another, radiating through his stomach and limbs. Now there was a dry, metallic taste in his mouth and his lips were prickling. He gave a groan and toppled off the seat onto the beach. A flapping on the sand beside his head reminded him of the scorpionfish. There came a lull in the spasms of pain. Instead, his whole body felt as if it was on fire, but beneath the agony, his brain cleared.
But of course, the experiment! Somehow he must get out to Octopussy and give her her lunch. Oh, Pussy, my Pussy, this is the last meal you'll get.
Major Smythe mouthed the jingle to himself as he crouched on all fours, found his mask, and somehow forced it over his face. Then he got hold of his spear, tipped with the still flapping fish, and clutching his stomach with his free hand, crawled and slithered down the sand and into the water. It was 50 yards of shallow water to the lair of the octopus in the coral cranny, and Major Smythe, screaming all the while into his mask, somehow mostly on his knees, made it. As he came to the last approach and the water became deeper, he had to get to his feet, and the pain made him jiggle to and fro, as if he was a puppet manipulated by strings. Then he was there, and with a supreme effort of will, held himself steady as he dipped his head down to let some water into his mask and clear the mist of his screams from the glass. Then, blood pouring from his bitten lower lip, he bent carefully down to look into Octopussy's house. Yes. The brown mass was still there. It was stirring excitedly. Why? Major Smythe saw the dark strings of his blood curling lazily down through the water. Of course, the darling was tasting his blood. A shaft of pain hit Major Smythe and sent him reeling. He heard himself babbling deliriously into his mask.
Pull yourself together, Dexter, old boy. You've got to give Pussy her lunch.
He steadied himself, and holding the spear well down the shaft, lowered the fish down towards the writhing hole. Would Pussy take the bait? The poisoned bait that was killing Major Smythe, but to which an octopus might be immune?
If only Bengri could be here to watch.
Three tentacles, weaving excitedly, came out of the hole and wavered round the scorpion fish. Now there was a grey mist in front of Major Smythe's eyes. He recognized it as the edge of unconsciousness, and feebly shook his head to clear it. And then the tentacles leapt, but not at the fish, at Major Smythe's hand and arm. Major Smythe's torn mouth stretched in a grimace of pleasure. Now he and Pussy had shaken hands. How exciting! How truly wonderful! But then the octopus, quietly, relentlessly, pulled downwards, and terrible realization came to Major Smythe. He summoned his dregs of strength and plunged his spear down. The only effect was to push the scorpion fish into the mass of the octopus and offer more arm to the octopus. The tentacles snaked upwards and pulled more relentlessly. Too late, Major Smythe scrabbled away his mask. One bottled scream burst out across the empty bay. Then his head went under and down, and there was an explosion of bubbles to the surface. Then Major Smythe's legs came up, and the small waves washed his body to and fro, while the octopus explored his right hand with its buccal orifice and took a first tentative bite at a finger with its beak-like jaws. The body was found by two young Jamaicans spinning for needlefish from a canoe. They speared the octopus with Major Smythe's spear, killed it in the traditional fashion by turning it inside out and biting its head off, and brought the three corpses home. They turned Major Smythe's body over to the police and had the scorpion fish and the sea cat for supper. The local correspondent of the Daily Gleaner reported that Major Smythe had been killed by an octopus, but the paper translated this into found drowned, so as not to frighten the tourists. Later, in London, James Bond, privately assuming suicide, wrote the same verdict of found drowned, together with the date, on the last page and closed the bulky file. It is only from the notes of Dr. Greaves, who performed the autopsy, that it has been possible to construct some kind of a postscript to the bizarre and pathetic end of a once valuable officer of the Secret Service. Octopussy was produced for Ian Fleming Publications by Lucy Fleming and directed by Enid Williams. It was first published in 1965.